access number 10599, reel 3.
Major English, reel 3. Do you recall the name of the ship that took you across to Cyprus, Major?
Yes, it was HMS Latoma, which, as I say, was a fast mine-laying cruiser. And the battalion was split into two, actually, in case of one of the ships being sunk. And the half of the battalion was on destroyer and the other half on the Latoma.
How long was the journey?
I suppose about 8 hours, mainly at night. Probably, perhaps less than that. But I know it didn't seem to take very long.
And you weren't interfered with in any way?
I weren't interfered with at all. And then, as I say, we arrived an hour or so after dawn in Famagusta Harbour. And the naval officers had impressed on us the necessity of getting off the ship with all our baggage and everything else absolutely as quick as possible. And they wanted to be way out of it as fast as they could. And we drove into they came into Famagusta Harbour, and the first officer was on the bows and the captain on the bridge. And the first officer had his walkie-talkie. And we came in at the most tremendous speed, and we heard him, number one, talking to the captain, saying, "You're 50 feet from the quay, sir. You're 30 feet from the quay, sir. You're 10 feet from the quay. You've fouled the quay, sir." An enormous bump. And then so we backed off and came in again, and they put down. We started filing off, and chaps carrying equipment and that sort of thing, which was really everything we had. And the Navy came to the conclusion this was far too slow. So they put ramps down the ship and just shoved everything off on these ramps, rain guns and weapons and baggage and everything. And a great heap on the quay, and inevitably some of them went into harbour. And I remember that Ross McLaren, the second in command, he had to organise a diver to go down and, or somebody to go down and pick some Bren guns and various other equipment out of the harbour and pay him out of PRI.
Was this one of the native people that
The Cypriots, yes. But anyway, one could see the Navy's point of view to some extent, and off they went again. And we were moved from Famagusta to Nicosia, and the task of the 8th Battalion was to build defences for Nicosia, the RAF station at Nicosia, which is now, of course, Nicosia Airport. And there was a squadron of Hurricanes there. And that's what we did for the next few weeks.
So you're building defences, and there was no time for training or anything?
We had the whole battalion involved, except one company, which was 2 or 3 miles away. One company and the carrier platoon, and they did training, and they were changed around periodically. The defences we built were really on a fairly considerable scale. Ross McLaren, who'd been was a mining engineer, picked out perhaps a dozen men that he knew would be in Pittman, and who knew the job, and he organized with the sappers, the all the supply and of everything, concrete and cement and aggregate and all this thing, and he took that over completely, and we built pillboxes and other fixed defences, and we really made the place fairly strong.
And did you have Cypriot labour to help?
There was a certain amount of that, but not a lot. There was one, looking back on it, amusing incident. I don't think it was amusing at the time. Was the second day we were in Cyprus. It was a Sunday, and after church parade, the men were allowed out, and they went out and into the local villages, and three or four hours after that, some of them came drifting back, and they'd been sampling the local drink, thinking it was beer, and we came back very much the worse for wear, and this gradually got more and more, and more chaps were carrying each other back, and eventually the guard room got far too small, and the next morning the CO had 250, I think, men up in front of him for being drunk and disorderly. And the next night it was a lot better, and I think there was about 17 in front of him, and after that there wasn't any, and they'd all learnt their lesson, this I don't know what you call it, but this particular Cypriot hooch had really laid everybody low.
What kind of punishments did he give for this kind of offence?
Well, they were given what was termed confined to barracks for so many days, and that meant obviously you weren't allowed out, but also they were used for various jobs under the provost sergeant, and when other people were going out they were set to clean this and clean the other, or dig some, maybe peel potatoes or whatever it was, and they were put to some work, and during the day of course they trained as normal with the rest of the chaps.
Was the morale good?
Yes. I think in due course we got a bit tired of digging trenches in around Nicosia Airport, and also it was very hot. But generally they were allowed one day off a week, and the officers were allowed half a day off a week, I remember.
What did they do on their one day?
Mostly went to Nicosia, which was about 3 miles away, I think. And we used to hire a taxi. I say we, that's two or three of us. I remember Major George Chambers and a chap who's no longer on this earth, I'm afraid, Tommy Preacher. We went over the mountains to a little port on the north coast of Cyprus, which was a lovely spot, really. We used to bathe there and that sort of thing, and then go back into Nicosia at night.
So was there plenty of leisure entertainment for both officers and men?
Well, I wouldn't say plenty. There was some. And one of the difficulties, of course, was that beer was very scarce, and one had to drink something else. And quite often it was Cyprus brandy, which is a variable quantity, rather, and people suffered a bit from that. but we did get an issue of beer occasionally from the Neffy.
Was there any problem with ladies and leisure or pleasure and the men?
I don't think there was a lot. They were obviously about in Nicosia, I mean, no doubt. We did have a few, but I think, if I remember rightly, there could probably be numbered in the fingers of one hand, you know, cases of VD. One or two people got rather bad desert sores. In fact, I know the MTO, George Blagden, he suffered considerably from that.
What caused those, Major?
Well, I don't really know whether you got whether it was started with a cut or something, and you get sand in and flies and it wouldn't heal. I don't think it was a deficiency, but some people were really weeks, you know, before they'd healed up.
Were there any other illnesses which were prevalent?
One or two initially could be trouble with heat, but and sunburn. You know, they took their shirts off and that sort of thing, and we had to stop that. Really, we had to give an order about that because they couldn't wear their equipment, and also initially. Until we got used to it, everyone had to wear these topees.
But were you pleased overall with the health of the men?
Yes. I don't think the doctor was kept too busy at all. It was an open-air life, and the rations were good, and people were pretty fit.
And accommodation, where were you accommodated?
We were all in tents. Dug into the ground. Normally, there's £180 a tent. Apart from, of course, the you maintained a normal system of sentries and so on. But and we had slightly bigger tents for mess tents. But everyone was on a reasonably active service footing. I mean, they fed by platoons and. Not in one big tent.
How did the Cypriots receive you, Major?
Well, generally speaking, they were friendly. We didn't I personally didn't have a lot of contact with them. The people in the nightclubs and pubs and things in Nicosia were. Well, they were keen to get their money, let's say, and I dare say occasionally they were guilty of overcharging. But I think they were quite glad to see us, really. And we had a few Cypriots, I say, working for us, and they were all right. We had a chap who used to bring a newspaper every day, and some of the men taught him to say, read all about it. Cyprus Post, read all about it. He used to come up shouting this through the camp. I think we had a really pleasant stay in Cyprus.
There was no feelings, did you detect, of any animosity between the Greek and the Turkish?
Well, there probably was, but this didn't come to us at all. I wasn't aware of that. We'd been told a bit about it, but it wasn't obvious at all.
So were you building defences and preparing for this kind of thing for the whole of the time that you were in Cyprus?
Yes. There was the odd exercise. There was a few signal exercises which only involved signalers and headquarters. But there was one or two movement exercises and that sort of thing. But generally, the 8th Battalion anyway, were pretty well tied up with this. Whereas one company we had did training, and I remember it was a B company, I think, laid on a firepower demonstration, which the B company in the carrier platoon, and the whole battalion turned out to see that. That was pretty fairly impressive. But yes, we were pretty well tied to our job up there. It would be interesting to see even Dixiel Airport now. It would be very different. No doubt.
And what about the men's fitness?
Well, as I said, we weren't too bothered with medical problems. I think probably their feet were soft. If we'd had to do a lot of marching, we might have felt it initially, because they weren't doing any of that. But otherwise, they were pretty good, as I say. Apart from, there was a little bit of what we term jippy tummy, a bit of diarrhea and this sort of thing, not a lot. And sunburns I've mentioned, but generally they were pretty good, really.
Were you able to organise sport?
To a certain extent, yes. There was not a lot. We, I remember, we got some cricket going, and the company that was on training, they had a football. They made quite a good football pitch, and they played, and we got a bit of that going at on the aerodrome as well. But. Generally speaking, it was mostly work, really.
What was had your position changed in any way? What rank were you holding at this time?
I was an acting captain, and I'd been, when I was brigade transport officer, I was made acting captain. No, I was still commanding the carrier platoon, but. The CO decided that I should remain battalion headquarters, not with the main body of the platoon. So I didn't do a lot of the training. At that stage, the carrier platoon was given a second officer, and we had a very good chap called Jack Carruthers. Now, he'd been in the TA for a few years before the war, and beginning of the war was a carrier platoon sergeant. He did well in France. He got a DCM, and he was given the immediate commission back in England. So he was running the training in this camp a few miles from where we were.
So what were your duties then?
Well, I was generally helping, seeing people were making, doing the headquarter, as far as the headquarter company goes, their defences. I must admit that in many cases I'd rather been back with a platoon, but anyway, that was good. That was how it was organised.
So about what time then did you leave Cyprus?
Yes, we left Cyprus on the 4th of November and went over to Haifa. We had some warning that this would happen, and that the 5th Indian Division would be relieving us. They'd been doing a lot of fighting. They'd been in the desert and then in Eritrea, and then back to the desert, they were due for a rest, perhaps. And they came over and took over from the 50th Division, and we were relieved by them, and we went to Haifa.
What do you recall of that journey?
Not a lot, really. Uneventful. And when we were in a camp just a few miles inland from Haifa, and the CO sent for me and said that he wanted me to take over MTO because George Blagden, as I think I mentioned, had suffered a lot with desert sores, and he was taken to hospital. And we knew we were going on a long trip up to northern Iraq. And we left all our vehicles in Cyprus, handed those over to the 5th Indian Division, and we took over their vehicles, which were mainly Indian Chevrolets, in other words, made in India. And they had done a considerable mileage. I mentioned that they'd been in the Western Desert and then down to Eritrea and back again. And most of them had at least 20,000 miles on the clock. And I think we had about 4 days in this camp, and as far as the MT was concerned, anyway, we were absolutely hectically busy. We had to see that everything was, all the stores were right, the tools were there, and fitting, carrying sand tracks and brackets for them, and checking this and checking the other, and getting spares, which wasn't always easy. And so they were. The platoon trucks, which were meant to be a 1,500 weight, and these were really basically 1,200 weights, and so they were, with all the platoon stores and equipment on, they were really slightly overloaded. And then the company commanders and one or two others had Ford pickups, 800 weights. And then the carrier platoon, they had to take over their carriers, which were part worn, to say the least. But they weren't going to go on that track. So they were taking on big lorries driven by Arabs when we set off. But there was a tremendous lot to do, and we left more or less in order, I think, but there was still quite a bit to do, and set off over the Jordan and up into Transjordan, and then out of the cultivated area and onto the desert, and through to Habaneh, which had been a peacetime RAF station, an important place. And the routine was always the same. We did, I don't know, 50, 60 miles perhaps, maybe a bit more, and pitched tents in the form of a square, really. Each company, each rifle company on the four sides of the square, and the battalion headquarters and the transport and the admin in the middle. And then, of course, the MT had to set to work to see that everything was right. And we had one or two breakdowns. The weak point of those trucks was the half shafts. And we had two or three go, and met the MT working late into the night to keep the things going. And then we ran out of half shafts, and I remember running around, going to various places, depots and things, to try and get more spares. And the LAD officer, that's the Light Aid Detachment, Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, they were attached to brigade headquarters, and the officer in charge of that was a man called Robinson, who was a very good chap indeed, very helpful. And he helped to keep us going, but it was quite a fraught time, really, because, as I say, these things were grossly overloaded, And the journeys during the day when on the desert were hot and dusty, and the riflemen were riding in 3-ton trucks, which are RAF sea transport, which had been given us especially for the purpose. And they got, we had all the covers off and that sort of thing, but they got pretty thirsty and dirty. So it was interesting to see new places, but it was quite a thing, really.
Did you have stops during the day?
Yes, we had one break during the day for half an hour. And due course, and particularly when we did the return journey and eventually up the desert, so people got very skilled, and we had these tins. At that time in the British Army, all the petrol came in flimsy thin tins which held I think 2 gallons. And they were the most dreadful things. I mean, the loss of petrol from these things cracking must have been absolutely enormous. And of course, we compared our things with the German jerry can, which were absolutely designed for the purpose. Excellent. And anyway, they were useful in that when they had the petrol poured out of them, or what was left in the tin, that made cooking stoves and this sort of thing, and quickly we had put a bit of sand in the bottom of these tins and a bit of petrol, poured in, and before you knew where you were, you had a brew of tea. And they were useful, all sorts of things, these tins eventually, but so we did have a stop, and each at breakfast each man was issued with a sort of lunch ration, and each truck made its own tea, and we were off again half an hour.
What kind of a lunch ration would that be?
Well, the norm might be a tin of something. Very often cheese and bread and some bully, perhaps.
Have you any other outstanding memories of the journey to Iraq?
We had both going and perhaps more particularly coming back trouble with the local Arabs, who were probably the most expert, perhaps as good as the Pathans of India as rifle thieves, and we were all warned about this. And each chap slept with the rifle tied to him. And some of the chaps dug a hole and laid the rifle underneath him, and with the sling attached to his arm. But there were sentries, probably rather more than normal, with loaded rifles. On the way up, we didn't have any bother, except that one or two people spotted and they were fired at, but I don't think we hit anybody. On the way back, we did lose a rifle, and this chap was, as I say, had the thing tying to him and lying under him, and this chap still got in and stole the rifle. It's absolutely unbelievable.